Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing coverage of the July 7th assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. There has been a lot of attention on who killed him and who will be the next president, but there is little attention about how Haiti got to this point and the role the international community, especially the United States, has played in shaping the social, political, and economic fabric of Haiti. Joining us to discuss this is Amy Wilentz, a contributing editor for The Nation. Her latest piece is called What Next for Haiti. Amy Wilentz is the author of many books, including Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She teaches literary journalism at the University of California, Irvine. Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. First off, can you just share a couple of basic facts about Haiti? As you write in your story, there needs to be so much more context in the coverage of Haiti. We're talking about a country of 11 million people. What other basic facts do we need to know about Haiti?
Well, I think one of the main things to understand about Haiti is that it's estimated at this point that a Haitian family lives on $800 a year. That's a year, and that's, I think it's a high estimate. So that you have a population that, although there's been so much money coming into Haiti over the years from the international community and from various non-governmental organizations that work there, the Haitian people are still suffering mightily. And that's for many reasons, partly the incompetence of the international community, partly the not entirely by the book behavior of Haitian governance.
$800 a year. Can we also just remind everyone about the 2010 earthquake that devastated Haiti? It killed 250,000 people, 300,000 people were injured, and 5 million were displaced.
Yes, so imagine that. That's in the capital city of Port-au-Prince, which is the biggest city in the country. There are some 2 million people there now. When I first got there in 1986, there were 800,000 people in Port-au-Prince. So it's a giant and very fast-growing city that was completely decimated, if not more than decimated, by this earthquake. And it destroyed many lives. It sent many people into further poverty. The country hasn't recovered from it, even though so much money was promised and a lot of it given, or at least provided to various organizations during the recovery effort. But there's still, the main streets are free now of rubble, but if you look down the side street, there's still rubble where the Haitian people live. It's had a lot of social upheaval because of the earthquake, with parents gone and children living on their own, or the other way around, giving a lot of sort of a strong foundation for insecurity, if you can have such a thing.
Let's talk about your recent piece. You really criticize mainstream media commentary on the assassination of the president. You write, a lot of the coverage has included many of the old racist tropes about Haiti, if not outright calling the country ungovernable, at least hinting that it is so, with comments about its inherently tragic cycle of chaos and crisis. Meanwhile, you write, these same explainers and anchors always somehow neglect to mention in their introduction to the Haiti experts they interview for 2 minutes, the sick dance the international community and especially the United States has engaged in with Haitian governance since these tropes first found their willing audience. Tell us what really specifically, elaborate on that and what strikes you about the coverage.
So what strikes me about, I don't want to be too specific and point fingers, but what strikes me about the coverage is that it reifies this belief that Haiti cannot be governed. Now, let's point out, as long as we're getting into facts about Haiti, that one of the reasons, and I think people are now giving more credence to the fact that history plays into the way we think about things today. One of the reasons Haiti is so shunned and so ignored and focus of so much racist underlying feeling in the mainstream media and in the international community is that Haiti had the first the only, in the modern world, successful revolt by an enslaved population that began in 1791 and ended with the expulsion of the French from Haiti in 1804. The French under Napoleon, with their international armies and their global reach, the Haitian enslaved population got rid of. So this was not much appreciated in 1804 by the young United States, which was still a functioning slave economy. And so was the rest of the imperial world, Britain, France, Spain. So this is one reason why these tropes survive until now. Another reason for this image of Haiti as ungovernable was the earlier assassination in Haiti of a president whose last name was Sam, as we would say in English, and who was assassinated after he committed an atrocious human rights violation of killing political prisoners. And then the United States came in 1915, and they had a marine occupation of Haiti until 1934, in which roads were built and bridges. There was infrastructure creation in order to enable U.S. businesses that were functioning there, sugar growing, rum production, coffee, mahogany extraction. But not much was done to make governance really responsive to the people's needs. And that ended in 1934 after a civil war with the Marines pitted against another revolutionary group, the Cacos. And that ended, but American involvement has continued. And I think many people agree with me, that the U.S. and the international community have continued to support unfortunate regimes while ousting ones that promised a little better for the Haitian people.
You know, since you brought up the history, can you talk a little bit more about what happened after that slave revolt, where French slave owners demanded compensation? And for years, people have been calling on France to return, it looks like it's between $17 and $21 billion.
Right. So after the revolution in 18, I think it was 27, the French said, look, you had your revolution, we left. You stole and burned our plantations. You stole our property, that property being not just the plantations and the territory, but the Haitian slaves themselves. So you stole yourselves from us, and we want compensation for that. This is, I don't know of another instance in history where the loser gets to demand compensation for what the victor has taken, but so be it. Haiti is always very eccentric in these ways. And so from 1827 to 1948, I believe, the Haitian state was paying off these huge sums in debt to France because France threatened, otherwise we will come in again, or we will just make you a pariah nation that cannot trade with any other nation. So the Haitians had to do it for their own survival. And it impoverished the country. I mean, imagine if the United States had been cut out of global trade in 1776, or if it had been reinvaded by the British in 20 years after the revolution, which it almost was, by the way. So I think you have to think about that, too, in terms of Haitians not being able to find their own government. Well, they could barely have their own economy because France was taking so much away. And speaking of the push to have those reparations repaid to Haiti by France, which profited so deeply from everything bad that happened in Haiti, France was among the nations that agreed to the ouster of the first freely and fairly elected president in probably Haitian history, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was the first president of Haiti to really raise the issue of repayment of reparations.
I mean, this history is so incredibly important. And over the years, as I said, people have been calling on France to pay back, and France has basically said no.
Yeah, well, France would say no. I mean, now I used to love Paris so much. I still do. But when I walk through Paris now, I just see the blood of the enslaved people, all the buildings, all the grandeur, everything Napoleon built, the pantheon of criminals. I just I went to the war museum. Haiti isn't even mentioned in the war museum in Paris because they won. The Haitians won. So it's a very painful and vexed history with France. And of course, they don't want to give it back. It's a lot of money and it's an acknowledgement.
Right. Today, we're joined by Amy Wilentz, a contributing editor for The Nation. Her latest piece is called What Next for Haiti? Amy will be with us for about 15 more minutes. So if you have any questions, comments about what is happening on the ground in Haiti, any comments about media coverage, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Amy, when it comes to U.S. interference in Haiti, can you also give us a little bit more historical context?
Well, I think we should talk about recent history because I think that's very important. So after this democratically elected president, Aristide, was ousted once and then again in 2004 while he was serving his second term, both of these ostensibly green-lighted by the U.S., the Americans and the international community knew that they had to have further elections. And first, there were various governments imposed on Haiti quickly, you know, like vaguely military juntas. And then there was the earthquake, and then there was the next election. And that was the election in which Michel Martelly came to power. He's a entertainer, a compas musician, very, very talented, quite charismatic. And that election was certified by the OAS and the international community with the assent of the United States. But it wasn't a very good election. It was much much controversy surrounded it. And but Martelly eventually prevailed. And then he tapped Moïse to become president. Moïse, a guy from the north of Haiti who had barely been to Port-au-Prince, who was a banana distributor in the north of Haiti. And but Martelly decided this should be the next president. He gave him his imprimatur. And then in another questionable election in which about 20% of the Haitian electorate voted and 600,000 people out of 11 million voted for Moïse, Moïse was elected in an election, again, so controversial that for a year after he was supposedly elected, there was an interim government. And then Moïse took his seat again with the seal of approval by the OAS and the international community. So there's been a lot of inmixing of the international community, including the United States, in these governments that have done so little for the Haitian people. I'm not saying it's easy to do a lot for the Haitian people, but with real determination and care, much, much more might have been done.
You write that one Haitian who knew Moïse during his presidency reminded you he threatened dozens of people and killed another handful and has been driving many people up the wall for years. Can you tell us, gosh, it's incredible, those voting numbers that you just shared. What did the people think of Moïse and what was that relationship like?
Well, I think there was a lot more admiration for Martelly when he was running because he was this great singer and he was funny and he was a comedian. He was very appealing to a certain sector of the Haitian people. So I think he had some popularity. Moïse, I have no idea, but I mean, nothing good now. So after his 5 years as president, I think that there's been a lot of just endless disappointment in the idea of the electoral process because the electoral process has been so corrupted and has brought the Haitians nothing. And what Moïse was planning to do in his last year in office was to have sort of quickie presidential elections along with a referendum on the Constitution, which basically he would control along with the international community yet again. So I think, you know, this is all led to the problem we see now of the lack of governability.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the corruption. As you write, Moise, Martelli, and their cohort were reportedly deep drinkers at the trough of corruption that absorbed most of the remaining monies. The same holds true of the fund that accrued from Petrocarib? The petroleum discount program Venezuela's Hugo Chavez established in Haiti under earlier governments. Once Martelli was in power, more than $2 billion in funds vanished, with Moise, not yet president, playing a part in that.
Yes, this is the case, according to a report by the Haitian Appeals Court. It's a 652-page report, which everyone cites as meaning that it must have weight, which it does have physically, but it also has weight in terms of being a Haitian document that actually looks at treasury records and bank records and sees what was going in and out and points the finger directly at those two politicians, among other politicians, as well as civilians in Haiti, of stealing this money that Hugo Chavez gave a discount to Haiti for petroleum. So that in itself was a great thing. But then the discount monies accrued in this account called Petrocaribe for social programs. And those social programs never were brought to fruition. And instead of using the money to help Haitians, the government basically used the money to line their own pockets. So this was another problem with the Moise government. And this is partly at the heart of the assassination, too, that Moise was threatening, because he had presidential power, to unmask others involved in the Petrocaribe scandal, while not, of course, acknowledging that he played any role.
So what is the status of organizations that speak out against this corruption, or journalists who expose this corruption?
Well, 8 days before Moise was killed, a journalist named Diego Schall was assassinated, along with his friend Antoinette Duclair, an outspoken human rights Petrocaribe activist, actually. And of course, nothing was done about that.
It's fine. Just talking about the status of groups that speak out against corruption. So, journalists.
Journalists have had a really hard time under Moise's government, and so have human rights activists, and so have demonstrators. And the chaos in the streets of Port-au-Prince has kind of stopped in its tracks the ability of the Haitian people to give the kind of giant demonstrations they're used to giving when they have had enough of a government, because the gangs in the streets are heavily armed and they've shot at demonstrators, as have the Haitian police. But there are groups, and there have been, I know, over the years, at least since the end of 2019, which is the last time I was in Haiti, there have been many groups, too many, one might say, of opposition leaders, opposition parties, and opposition organizations, human rights organizations, organizations that work with shantytown populations, who've gotten together to propose another way for Haiti, a way that is not the Moise way, a way that is separate and better and new for Haiti, which would be involving the Haitian people in their own fate as opposed to just running over them. And there's a group now called the Commission to Search for a Haitian Solution that's operating now and working with the international community and trying very hard to find a better way out of the situation than having the fired prime minister of Moise run the country. The day after he was fired, Moise was assassinated, and he is now the interim chief of governance in Haiti.
And can you tell us, what can you tell us about him?
Very little. I mean, he's like a political.
Oh, did we just lose Amy? Well, we're going to try to connect with Amy Wilentz, contributing editor for The Nation. Her latest piece is What Next for Haiti? Amy is the author of several books on Haiti, including Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti, and she teaches literary journalism at UC Irvine. So we talked about Amy's criticism of the media coverage. And Amy writes, let's just talk about what's going on with the United States. So Amy writes that the Biden administration seems to have decided almost immediately in the wake of the assassination to support Prime Minister Claude Joseph as acting president to take Haiti to elections, although there is no clear succession to the presidency for a prime minister under Haitian law. Moïse appointed Joseph in April and in his act as president fired him on July 5th. Having fired Joseph, Moïse appointed another prime minister to succeed him, also on that same fateful day in his last presidential act. Amy, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. Not sure what happened. So we were talking about who's in charge right now, and can you tell us more about him?
Well, as you were pointing out, he was fired. He's already fired, this guy. He's a political operative. He's been in and out with Moise's and Martelly's party. And now he's being shunned by that party because they don't want him to be in charge. He's, you know, basically an unimportant figure who I think is very temporary and we will not be seeing for very long. The United States, interestingly, and this is a tiny, tiny sign of hope from the United States, is not going along with the sort of whoever's in power narrative that one desperately might cling to in a situation like this that's so fluid. And they have said they will not support him. They will not support the person Moïse appointed to replace him. And they will not support the person who has been nominated to be president of Haiti by the 10-person Haitian Senate that remains after its decimation during the Moïse regime. So the United States is saying, look, give us somebody new that we can actually think about seriously.
And the other question I wanted to ask before we lost you, what is the status of the petroleum discount program? What's the status of that today?
That's over because of all the problems in Venezuela and the American sanctions against Venezuela and Chavez. Chavez's death, his replacement by a less competent, less charismatic figure, Maduro, and all the problems that have ensued in Venezuela. And there is no more fund. The fund has been depleted and looted by whoever depleted and looted it. Check the 652-page report by the Haitian Appeals Court.
What can you tell us about the violence? You mentioned the gangs, and the Guardian reports that violence has pushed 8,500 women and children from their homes in Haiti's capital in the past 2 weeks. According to the Haitian National Human Rights Defense Network, there are close to 100 gangs active in Haiti, controlling more than half of the country. So tell us about the root causes of this and how it got so bad.
Well, the general understanding about this is that without a competent army and without a competent police force and with a population that is starving and living on $800 a year, people need jobs, people need money, and there's no law and order. So it's a moment ripe for gangs, young men living in the shanty towns. They're looking for work and somebody has the money to fund them. And so there may be like about 100 gangs in Haiti, but there are about 20, 25 in Port-au-Prince that are really powerful. One is called G9, and it's an amalgamation of 9 gangs, many shantytown-based or popular neighborhood-based. And it's run by a guy, you know, it can be very colorful there. And it's run by a guy named Jimmy Cherizier. His nickname is Barbecue, which he says is because he likes to barbecue things. But people think it's because he likes to light fires in people's houses and light people on fire. So it's that kind of thing. And they are heavily armed. They have great vehicles. They're responsible for most of the kidnappings. And kidnapping is a business there. Gang actions are a business. The most recent gang activity before the president was killed in the weeks leading up to his assassination was an absolute takeover of the southern areas at the edge of Port-au-Prince, which opened up for the gangs and for whomever else the largest roads from the port to the airport. Now, you know, that can be transshipment, a need of transshipment, but this was basically several gangs warring over it and then one taking over. But it's made when they say almost a half of the country is run by gangs, this is the large section. And the gangs have cut off access to the southern parts so that people have to fly to the southern parts of the country if they want to get there.
So what is next? I mean, we didn't even have time to talk about COVID, which has been devastating in Haiti. You know, talking about the poverty, gangs, lack of clean drinking water, education, lack of security. What is next for the Haitian people?
Haiti has to stop being run by a gang of criminals and start being run by responsible people. And that is the side on which the Americans and the international community should be standing. They've worked too long with advisors who come from the business class and the business mafia, because they all speak English, they all have nice houses, they all seem utterly rational, they're all fun to hang out with, they go to discos, they live a life completely different from the Haitian people, and basically they do not have the interests of the Haitian people in mind when they advise the international community. The international community has to step up and be brave and help work for a new solution in Haiti and not the same old, same old. It's really, really important right now. This is a crisis like none I've seen in Haiti, and I've been working there for more than 30 years. And it's worse than the earthquake. It's another earthquake.
Is there any viable opposition that can stand up to the corrupt elite in the country and the international community?
Well, I would say that the international community working with the viable people who've been thinking about how to lead Haiti for a long time is an alternative. But the international community cannot be the intellectual authors of the new Haiti, because they haven't shown that they are wise enough and that they care enough about popular needs and sentiment. It has to be a Haitian-led new government with international backing. And therefore, the Haitians also have to rise to the occasion and present the international community with something the international community can really stand by and not feel like it's going to be deserted and have a Haitian bomb explode in its hands yet again.
Amy Wilentz is a contributing editor for The Nation. You can find her latest piece, What Next for Haiti, at yourcallradio.org. Amy, thanks for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up after a quick break, we are going to talk about voter suppression in the U.S., and we will also talk about the current state of gerrymandering. David Daley reports that Republicans can win the next elections through gerrymandering alone. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.